All right, this is tape two, side A. You were talking about going to Hiroshima University and why you went there. Your mentor at that, and we should get his name down. I'm going to mangle this.
Dr.
I'll let
Niwa.
You do it.
Dr. Niwa.
Niwa, okay.
Yeah.
And describe his the management style that he had. How did he run his lab?
Oh, so this is unique to, well, it's quite a bit different from U.S. style, actually. In Japan, so he was assistant professor at the time, and he was a full professor, and basically assistant professors work for full professors. So it depends on the school or depends on the lab, so, but in many labs, still, assistant professors don't have real independence in research. So I was, though, exceptional in that I applied to him directly. Again, I was not either aware of the system or I didn't think it was important. I don't remember. I didn't even think about it, I think. But anyway, the professor at the time was reasonably understanding person. So he said, okay, you know, you came to Niwa's place, so you are not my student, so you should be, you know, directly studying with Niwa, which was very unusual for that laboratory. So I was the only student he had at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And probably, I was the first, very first real student for him.
Mm.
So we worked very close together for, throughout my education, and he, so how part of him, his work was actually to do work for his boss, his full, the full professor of the laboratory, and the 50% of the time he would do research for his own interest. So basically, I took over that part,
mm-hmm.
And that was research institute, and he did not have to do teaching much at all, so he was in the lab all the time, so that was good. So we had bench back to back, and he was working at the bench a lot of times. And he was a little unusual, I think, in a sense. So he had a lot of influence on me for coming to the U.S., I think, because he did he got PhD at Stanford, which is very unusual. For someone at his age. And when he was in graduate school, I think there was this very strong student movement, and there was a lot of schools that were shut down and so on and so forth. And he didn't like it. So he, I think he thought about quitting research. So he came to the U.S. and did a technician for a year, then enrolled a graduate program at Stanford. Then he got the degree there, and then went back to Japan to take research position. So in Japan, usually graduate school does not provide any education, believe it or not. So there's no single class I took. It's very common. It might have changed a little bit, but because there's no postdocs in Japan almost, graduate students are sort of main workforce in Japan.
Right.
So they're used as cheap laborers. So what people do basically is come into the lab and do their own experiments all day and go home. That's it. No teaching.
Right.
No classes to take. No, they don't do teaching either. They don't do teaching assistant. So they come out, no experience of teaching, no lectures to receive. So depending on your mentors, the level of knowledge you can get will be completely different. In some laboratories, students basically use as parts of big factory. So in extreme case, you might have PhD who have been doing cloning, one type of experiment, for 4 years. What was fortunate for me was because Dr. Niwa had education in Stanford, he knew the U.S. system. He knew it, how important it is to have broad knowledge. So he, even though I didn't have to take classes, we had pretty strict reading assignment. So, for example, I may or may not have that in here. This is a famous textbook for molecular biology called Genes. It's written by Ben Lewin, who used to be editor for Cell. And it has something like 800 pages. And we needed to read that in 8 weeks, which was a lot for Japanese who are not used to reading English.
Right.
We had to read in English, of course. Not only that, we had to explain in front of him. So, you know, just reading for yourself versus reading and explaining is like completely different. You need a lot better understanding. So that was a huge training. It was hard. But I didn't want to give up. So I did that. And after that, he gave us similar assignment, reading a journal called Trends in Genetics, which was hard because it deals with all sorts of different problems, from plant genetics to E. coli, I mean bacterial genetics to human genetics. So it doesn't matter. We have to read all the articles and present that in front of him. That was good training, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And so he was very high on training me. And there was another fellow student who was studying, who was there for the professor, but she was treated. She joined the reading assignment. So we did that. It was good training. I'm very thankful that he did that with me.
Yeah, that sounds very rigorous.
Yeah. And because he had his family left in Kyoto, he was living alone, so he pretty much had life like I am having right now. So he would come in late and stay until like midnight or 1 o'clock. So we were there for, I don't know, maybe 14 hours a day together, or every day. And very often, after both of us were done with work, we would just drink together in the office,
right,
and talk about all kinds of things. So it was very good training, one-to-one, basically. Mm-hmm. And then my professor retired, and he was promoted to be a full professor. And then after, about the time I left, he got 3 or so graduate students. So he's having more people right now with him. Mm-hmm. And he moved to Kyoto finally to be with his family. And he's very happy over there.
Right.
So his style was very special, I think. That's not very typical. One-to-one and very thorough training.
Right. Now, given that, given the closeness between the two of you in those 6 years, what was the focus of your research, and then what was its evolution?
Right. So, one thing about him, my mentor, Dr. Niwa, is he's really, really smart. In smart means, in this case, very fast in picking logical flow. For example, someone talks about something, he'll say, oh, that's logically incorrect because of this and that. Or if he has to write about something that he's not really working on, he can go through journals and write the review about it in a couple weeks. He was really good at those things. One thing that he was not very good at, maybe because he was so smart, is to stick with one thing and keep working on something for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
So he's interested in like 10 different things all the time. And I don't think he ever worked on one thing for a long time in depth. But that was his personality. And very often he get too excited about something easily, without thinking really in detail. He just starts working on something that sounds sexy, but you know, things get stuck very often. So initially, the project I was assigned, or I agreed to work on, I should say, didn't work out because the assumption was too naive, I think. But anyway, general interest we had at the time was why early embryos are so multipotent,
So basically, one cell becomes whole body, and we knew until like 10-20 divisions are done in mammalian system, every cell can differentiate into every tissue.
Mm-hmm.
So that means that those cells have potential to differentiate in any way, but it's suppressed. And how that specificity is defined was the center of the question. Or how I should say, how that multipotency is kept in our embryos was the interest for us, because the way those tissue-specific information is kept should be reversible, because that those cells should be able to differentiate in every tissue.
Mm-hmm.
But yet, the suppression should be pretty strong, because if you start prematurely differentiating, you can end up with having body without head or hands or whatever. So that was the biggest interest. And let's see. To make the long story short, basically we wanted to find a magic key regulator in this early embryo that's doing suppression.
Right.
And the assumption, if my student comes up with that idea right now, I would laugh, because there's no proof that there's a key regulator, but it was a really good, cool idea. So we came up with a way to screen for that regulator, and I spent a year, full year, I think, trying to isolate this regulator. It went nowhere, of course. So we stopped doing that. But instead, we didn't change direction completely, but decided to use different model system. That is, we knew that a lot of viruses are adapted to grow in differentiated tissues because they infect bodies, not embryos. So consistent with that, those early embryos that can differentiate into any cell type are completely resistant to viruses, because most of the viruses just cannot grow at all.
Mm-hmm.
In our embryos. So we decided to use one of those viruses, retrovirus, mouse retrovirus, as a model system, and decided to look for factors that repress gene expression of the virus. And I ended up with identifying a protein repressor for this virus transcription unit, and that was my thesis basically.
Hmm.
And later a competitor in North Carolina identified the same factor and showed that this factor is required to make male. If you knock it out, all the progeny become female. That was pretty interesting.
Right.
So I enjoy that work a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So that was sort of the first, I guess, of my research in sort of gene expression lineage. It's funny that I'm still working on repression, not by choice, just ended up with working on it, but. Looks like I'm doing similar things even now.
Right. Talk a little bit about your typical day in that lab. When would you usually come in? You said you worked 14-hour days.
At the time. I used to show up somewhere between 10 and noon. And I usually stayed there until 1 or 2.
Mm-hmm.
And so I would get up and wash my face and eat something, and then go to the lab. I always live close to my lab so that I can go to the lab quickly. So it was something like 5 minutes to the lab. So then I would go to the lab, do some experiments, have lunch and work, then have dinner, and then work, then I go home and sleep. Right. That was it.
simple and direct.
Yeah. And a year after that, my girlfriend decided to go to graduate school in Kyoto, which was 2 hours by train. So we started commuting on weekends, every other week, actually. So only on weekends, I would go to either Kyoto or she would come to Hiroshima.
Okay.
So, but she was a year junior to me, so for about a year, I was in Hiroshima, she was in Obihiro, so we met like twice or something like that.
Right. In this lab, what were you learning anything about the running of a lab, about the culture of science? Not so much, let's say, you know, discovering repressors and whatnot, but how to actually run it.
That in Hiroshima.
Right.
So I laughed because that was a horrible lab in terms of organization.
not to run a lab.
I learned a lot about what not to do. So as I said, my supervisor was a wonderful person, but this professor was a very messy person, even though he was nice to me personally. So he had some political power for unknown reason at the institute. So even though usually in Japan, in Japanese labs, it's one full professor, one assistant professor, and couple research assistant professors, and usually those three work for full professor. That lab had four research assistant professors. For unknown reason, they're about the same age. At the time, they're like 40, 41, something like that. They were all competing with each other. They hated each other. And it was very clear that nobody was getting along. And there were a lot of personal conflicts. And believe it or not, there are incidents that one would sneak into someone's tissue culture and contaminate tissue culture with bacteria. Mm-hmm. Because that happened so frequently, the one who was suffering isolated bacteria that was inoculated, and sure enough, there was plasmid in it that's used in laboratory. So it was pretty clear that that was done on purpose. Even though I wouldn't say that person was not nice either in other aspects. So it's not like someone was good and someone was bad. I think everybody was having trouble.
Mm-hmm.
And then everyone was having independent projects, but I don't know, there were a lot of troubles, which later caused a huge headache to my supervisor when he was promoted to full professor. And a lot of them actually left the lab already, and so it ended up with being okay. But so what I decided to do is to be fair for science. So if I'm asked for something, reagents or protocol, I help people as much as possible, no matter what my relationship with them might be at the time. Other than that, I don't do anything. That was my position. So I helped a lot of people, I think, and I really didn't get help from them. But so after that lab, I mean, every lab, of course, has some problem, but it's not a problem for me. I've seen the worst, probably. So, in a sense, it was not a bad training. It was part of a training, I should say.
Yeah.
That I was in such a horrible laboratory. I mean, it's like, you know, I was a graduate student, those more senior people would come to me one by one saying, you know, bad things about the other faculty members. I mean, what can I say? I just ignore them.
Mm-hmm.
And it was very clear that they hated each other, and yeah, there was not most pleasant environment. But again, because my supervisor was a nice person, and that was fine.
Right. Did you do anything outside of the lab? Did you have any moments where you had sort of leisure activities?
So basically, my life had only two aspects, either science or with my girlfriend. Mm-hmm. So every other weekend, I would spend some time with my girlfriend. We both like hiking and bird watching, so we did that kind of thing a lot. Mm-hmm. I didn't have a car at the time because it's very expensive to have a car in Japan. So we had to rent a car to go birding or long hiking, but we did that. And also, every year, at least twice a year, we'd have camping trip. Mm-hmm. So that was fun. That was about it. Life was very simple at the time, even now, actually.
So just out of curiosity, why is it so expensive to have a car then?
Oh, parking space.
Oh, okay.
You have to pay something like, now I don't know, I would assume something like $500 to $1,000 per month for a parking spot.
Oh my God.
In Japan. And the taxes are high, and you have to have your car checked up every other year, and that costs like $1,000.
Mm-hmm. And you mean like desmogged or?
No, they check like really detail. It takes one full day usually, and they check brake fluid, gears, tires, and everything. They always find something wrong,
right?
And you have to pay for that. And the gas is three times more expensive than this country.
Yeah.
Like everything is expensive. So just having a car is a luxury.
Yeah.
But that way it should be, because the whole country is the size of California, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And the population is half of this country. So it's
that
like,
is amazing.
Yeah. The density. I mean, there shouldn't be a lot of cars, in my opinion.
A question maybe I should have asked earlier. How did you pay for college?
That one. So my, I applied for scholarship, but I was not qualified. I think they refused to tell us the reason. I think that's because my father's income was too high.
Mm-hmm.
That's only because my father believed that, you know, grown-up adults should pay for education. At least partly. So he asked me to apply for college, and I didn't get it. So he said, okay, fine, I'll pay for it. So my father paid for it.
Mm-hmm.
And in Japan, it's rare, extremely rare, for students to pay for their education at all. Most of the time, parents pay full.
Right.
And in grad school, it's the same. In Japan, you have to pay to be a grad school student. You don't get paid. Yeah, I always tell this to my students. You guys are getting paid to do research. I paid, and of course I didn't have time to have a second job to pay for my life. So I was supported my parents for a couple of years. Then I started receiving this fellowship, which basically paid all I needed. So I still have a loan back in Japan, which I'm paying like $100 a month. I'm paying back that loan. But that's no interest, everything. So it's a pretty good deal. That's right. I was receiving that loan and a fellowship from Japan.
Right.
Japanese Society of Promotion of Science or something like that.
Mm-hmm. All right, you get your PhD in 1991,
mm-hmm.
and the next step is, well, what was the next step? How are you seeing the future? You eventually come.
So at the time, I was pretty clear I wanted to come to the U.S. for postdoc, and as I said, a lot of that is probably influenced by Dr. Niwa. He told me repeatedly how great his experience was in the U.S., and he still comes to the U.S. Often for meetings and things. And I was pretty firm that I wanted to come to the U.S. as a postdoc. I didn't think about after that, though.
Right.
I usually don't think much about my future in detail. So that was clear. And I, of course, talked to my girlfriend about it all the time. She also wanted to come to the U.S. Because she, for women, even now, it's not easy. It's probably easier to come to the U.S. to do well, mm-hmm. to be respected, I guess. And she had no problem coming to the U.S. To do research.
Right.
And everyone in the lab, I was doing PhD, knowing my character, personality, said, once you went to U.S., you won't be back to Japan.
And they pegged you.
Right, you know.
So why, what were the other, what were the postdocs that you were considering?
So that's, that probably shows you why, how I'm indifferent about my future. I actually didn't think much about, so, so first, there are, so, okay, let's see how to start. So when we started thinking about doing postdocs, my girlfriend already had a place she wanted to go at the NIH because her supervisor was a had a sabbatical with Dr. Marco Martin at NIH, and he had a very good experience, and they were still working very close. So she wanted to go to the place, and Malcolm's lab was one of the good labs, and he already mentioned to her supervisor that he would take her.
Mm-hmm.
She was extremely productive as a graduate student, and it was no problem finding her position for him. So obviously, I could have looked places at NIH, and NIH is a huge place. It's easy for two people to find a job. But also, I wanted to look for other places. So when I was thinking about postdocs, I was doing a lot of biochemistry, molecular biology in using mouse embryo system or model system for embryos. But I was very aware that we hit the wall, really, at the end of our research. The reason is because we were not into development much. We were using cell lines. Number two, we couldn't do any biochemistry. It was very hard for us to go into the mechanism. We just couldn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very frustrating for me. So I thought there are two ways to go to do a postdoc. One is to do study mouse development rather than tissue culture cells. The other is to do biochemistry so that I can go deep into the mechanisms if I want to. So originally, I thought going to doing mouse work is higher priority. So I contacted a few labs that I was interested in. One of them was Hal Weintraub, who was here at the mm-hmm. time. He immediately wrote me a very nice letter saying that basically lab is completely full, so I cannot take you. I didn't know that at the time that he was always having this much of application.
Hmm.
He was such a nice guy. I also contacted a couple of people in other places than NIH, and I didn't get a good answer immediately because I happened to choose really famous labs at the time. Then there was another one lab at the NIH was doing mouse work, and that person told me you can come. So I thought it's set. And not that I actually read a lot about her, or not that I read her papers much, but I was a little unhappy about our contact. That is, I was trying to apply for fellowship, and I would write to her. At the time, there was fax. Email was not there.
Mm-hmm.
So I would fax her something, and she wouldn't get back to me for like 2 weeks, usually. And I was not sure. Maybe she thought, you know, I didn't know at the time that at NIH, you really don't have to bring in your own money because money is so abundant. But I wanted to make sure that I get funding just in case. Maybe that's why she didn't think it's important. anyway, she didn't explain that to me. So I was a little bit concerned. Then I was, I still remember this. So the, as a whole lab, Hiroshima, we went to a trip for leisure purpose, not for science or anything. And I woke up at night and I thought about that not very pleasant interaction with this person. Then came up with a notion that there's another place I can apply for. That is, at the time I was in collaboration with another lab at, in Japan, because the factor I cloned from mouse embryos happened to be a homologue of Drosophila, a fruit fly gene, mm-hmm. that was isolated by another researcher in Japan. That guy just came back from Carl Wu's lab at the NIH. He was one of the first postdocs for Carl. And I was hearing from him how great his experience was with Carl. And then suddenly it occurred to me, oh, maybe I can go to Carl's lab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was not thinking about Carl's lab because he was using Drosophila as a model system, and I was thinking about mouse work. But then I thought maybe, you know, working, and Carl was, is still a very good biochemist. So maybe rather than going to embryos, going to one particular system, learning biochemistry so that I can do mechanism work later on might be also fun. Then I just basically decided that night that I want to go to Carl's lab. And I wrote a letter, and Carl said, okay, come on. Later it turned out it's very rare for him to take anyone without even meeting, but because he knew Hitoshi, who was my collaborator, who was a postdoc with Carl, and Hitoshi recommended me to Carl very highly. He took me basically without me seeing me.
Right.
So that's how I decided to go to Carl's lab. So right now my student is looking for postdoc position, and when he asked me he should look for a job, I say, like, oh, you have to think about this and that, but then at the end I have to say that, by the way, I didn't do it in the way I said you should do. I just basically decided on, like, one day. The way I chose my graduate lab was basically the same thing. I read one piece of paper and just, okay, I want to go to this place. It's been working.
Yeah, apparently. Before we get you to Carl Wu's lab and talk about how very productive you were, a lot of great papers came out of that, I wanted to get to the transition from Japan to America. Had you been to America before?
Once, yes, for a meeting.
Okay.
Cold Spring Harbor meeting, and I and Dr. Niwa and my girlfriend came to the meeting. I think at the time we already knew we were coming to the U.S. as a postdoc, so it was a year before we came or something like that.
Okay.
So we flew to New York and then attended the meeting. We both presented the poster. We didn't understand what people were talking about. The funny thing is, my poster was reasonably popular, and there was a guy who was really interested in my work, and he asked me really detailed questions about it. I told him, I answered all the questions. He stayed there, and other people started asking me questions, which I didn't understand. So this guy started answering questions in my place.
He was your interpreter, as it were.
So I still remember that. So that was the only trip to U.S. before that.
Right. And what was your impression of America on that first trip?
It was intense. It was real fun. Of course, you know, being in a place that you're not completely comfortable about language is really intense. And
how was your English then?
It was okay. I could speak, but not very fast. And vocabulary was obviously not there. But grammar-wise, I was okay, I think. So when I wanted to say something really slowly, it was okay. especially to scientists, because they're used to foreigners' English. But hearing was horrible, because we learn English on paper, basically.
Yeah.
So, as you know, how it's written, how you read, is completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So it was very hard to pick up what people say. But it was okay. It was really enjoyable. I had a good time. On the way back to Japan, we actually stopped by in Seattle because we, you know, since it's a big trip for us, we wanted to have a little bit of extra stay. I actually don't remember why we chose that, but we decided to go to Rainier, Mount Rainier.
Mm-hmm.
And believe it or not, we rented a car at Seattle Airport and drove to Rainier, and we made it. And in Japan, we drive on the other side,
right,
like in Britain. And also, we didn't understand what the lady at the counter was saying to us, but she gave me a key, and we drove. It was intense, though, because we never drove freeway in this country, and the road to I-5 was is not that clear, actually. You have to take a ramp that's really narrow. It doesn't look like it's a major way to go to any freeway, but we somehow made it. And stayed in a lodge at in Rainier, which is wonderful. And we just happened to see a scientist from Tokyo who was there for a different meeting. And we didn't know each other, but he was staying on a lodge, in a lodge on the top of, one of the high places in at Rainier. And he invited us for dinner, and we had very memorable dinner there, and then we flew back to Japan. That was really, really fun.
That would be great.
Yeah, that was quite an adventure, actually. On the way back to return the car, I once made a wrong turn and went to the wrong side of the road.
Right.
And I saw cars coming to me. I turned around, didn't have a big problem.
That was pretty terrifying.
Yeah.
That happened to me today, by the way, too. A motorcyclist was coming at me, too.
Really?
Downtown. It was one of those one-way street things.
In any
case, that skinny little ramp that you talked about that doesn't seem to be going to the 5, I also took that today. So this is all resonating quite well. When you come back again, though, a year later, had your English improved in that time?
No.
No, okay.
Yeah, I didn't take any classes or anything. Oh, maybe a little bit, actually. In Hiroshima, in a vet school, in a graduate school, there were a couple of foreign students. One of them was from Bangladesh, and only the language we could communicate was English. So I talked to him a lot. So, but not like every day, basically. So it might have been a little better, but not significantly, I don't think.
Right.
Though I think my English was okay from the beginning, because I remember first day I showed up in the lab, I was told to go to secretary's office, and I got explanations about the keys and blah, blah, blah. Then Carl showed up, and Carl was expecting that I won't be speaking English much at all, I think. So security said, "Carl, this guy speaks English." And I saw Carl's face, and I could tell he was very embarrassed because security told me, basically, that Carl already told her that don't expect this guy to understand or speak English.
Right.
So I was not very fluent, I don't think, but it was functional at the time.
Yeah. And this is in Bethesda, right? You're in Bethesda,
right,
Maryland.
That's correct.
Yeah. And how about American culture? How are you adjusting to that?
I actually didn't have any problem at all. I don't know, maybe because It's not that different, I don't think, from Japan, or at least modern part of Japan, mm-hmm. or maybe because I stay in the lab all the time, I don't do much else. But I did not feel like I wanted to go back to Japan even a single time, I'm pretty sure.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I have been very happy. I mean, I have been happy basically throughout my life, as far as I can remember.
Right.
So it's not that different. But I think people are right that when they said that, that you won't come back to Japan.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I can't complain.
Yeah. All right, let's get you into the lab again. In Wu, again, I'll ask the same question. What was the focus of your research from that point? You
right.
obviously were making a key transition, it seemed,
right.
from another model system.
Right. So I changed the organism. I changed the technique. So from molecular biology to hardcore biochemistry. And I changed the subject. I also changed language.
Right.
So that was quite a bit of adjustment, I think. The focus of research was, let's see. Initially, so Carl was one of the first person who described in 1980s, I think, that when gene, there's an active gene, that region of chromatin becomes open, more accessible. So my subject of study was to reconstitute that in test tube. The reason is because previous postdoc who left like half a year before I joined the lab had established one of the first in vitro or test tube system to assemble chromatin-like structure in test tube. So he wanted me to use that system to reconstitute what happens in cells, which is very dangerous, high-risk, high-return kind of project. I knew that from the beginning. And when I told other colleagues in Carl's lab what my projects were, some people said, ooh, do you think it's going to work?
Right.
But I didn't really care. One thing I may or may not have told you is in both vet school and graduate school, I was this project I had were new to the lab, so I had to establish the system from scratch in all the laboratories I was in. So I felt comfortable starting something new,
right,
in the lab, and that was probably one of the best education training I got throughout. Graduate schools, I think,
right,
to establish new system. So because of that, I didn't have a lot of hesitation in trying something new.
Yeah.
In Carl's lab.
Well, it's funny in reading some of the Pew documents they give us on the Pew Scholars, there's a letters of recommendation in there, and I like reading them because certain themes do come out. And one of the themes that came out repeatedly for you was being a quick study, being able to pick up these systems quickly and adjust and find your feet and move on. That came up again and again.
I see.
Yeah.
That's interesting because I consider myself slow in picking things up.
So you felt, in other words, in sort of familiar territory, having to sort of start from scratch,
mm-hmm.
even though it was all in another country now,
mm-hmm.
in the language. Okay. And so you picked it up, and how did the research go?
So in Carl's lab, he gives difficult projects to everyone. So it's almost expected you struggle.
Right.
As a result, some people burn out and quit science. But he publishes in very good journals. And my project was no exception. In first full year, basically, I spent time getting reagents ready to to do the experiment. So mm-hmm. I couldn't even do the experiment in the first 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
So I joined Carl's Lab in 92, I think, April. Then this time I started real experiment was in 90, early 93, I'm pretty sure.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't just have reagents that I could use, because that in vitro experiment I mentioned is real high maintenance. A lot of things need to be right. So you need a lot of different reagents, they're all in working condition. If one stops working, it takes weeks to figure out what's wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So to keep maintain the system running, it was a lot of work. So it was a struggle at the beginning, but I really didn't care. I think that's kind of reason why my girlfriend says I don't have receptor. I think seriously. Uh-huh. So I really didn't worry about my experiment or anything. I was having fun. It was really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 6 weeks after we arrived here, we had a huge accident, and that slowed me down a little bit. But other than that, not much was happening.
If I may ask, what was the accident? Was it
I was turning left. It was Sunday, and it started to rain. So a lot of people rushing home.
Right.
And again, the turning left is a small turn in Japan, but it's a big turn in this country. So mm-hmm. I didn't pay attention to the car coming straight. So I was turning left, and then the car hit the right side of my car, and my girlfriend was later found out that cracked four ribs and pelvis, mm-hmm. and she got unconscious. I got scared, and it could have been a lot worse though, because the rescue needed to cut out the door to get her out.
Right.
So fortunately, she didn't have any bleeding at all, internally mm-hmm. or externally, so she could get out of hospital in like 10 days.
Mm-hmm.
But it took her a while to be able to walk normally.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like 6 weeks after we came to the country, so we barely spoke English. That was scary. We didn't know the system at all. And the hospital billing system is completely different, and I didn't understand why I get so many different bills from different doctors.
Yeah.
And I had to, you know, get onto ambulance, and the police came in to me and explained